I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in such a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions as scientifically decided by us and what we define as interesting. Isaac Asimov once said, the most exciting phrase in science is not Eureka, but that's funny. Respectfully, Isaac, we think you can have a bit of both. I'm Rick Edwards, and this is my long-term partner.
Oh,
it's quite nice. Isn't it?
It's almost a promotion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Brooks here, brains of the outfit.
Every time you say brains of the outfit, you're smirking because you know it isn't true.
So, Rick, been enjoying the weather?
I mean, sort of ish. You?
This time of year is not great for the garden. You know, I'm in the garden a lot, obviously, because I work so hard.
Yeah. I mean, you are 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
But when you say things like, I worry about the garden, you seem about 30 years older. Just so you know. But what about my, what is it? What's your favourite bush? What about my rhododendrons?
I've got a magnolia tree that I'm particularly attached to.
Right, that'll do. Oh, my magnolia tree.
It's not, well, the thing is, water. Right, you know, exactly. You know, this time of year, you can't rely on the water. So, it's not just about having nice weather. It's about having the right kind of, you know, environment for your garden. And then,
stop going on about your garden.
And then, right, I got an email about World Water Week.
Bertie Big Bollocks got an email, didn't he?
World Water Week, right? So every year, scientists get together, they gather in Stockholm, they're talking about all the global issues with the oceans and about like access to water across the world. And then, and then I was reading something about the Ukraine war and how the first thing the Russians did was basically take control of the North Crimean Canal and blow up a dam so that their crops, basically, that are in Crimea could be watered. You know, and, like, water's just everywhere in my mind at the moment.
No, I mean, you are, to be clear, a barrel of laughs.
Well, you know.
So I'm assuming then we're going to talk about water this week.
We are going to talk about water this week because it's insane how much water matters. And basically, you have to wonder how long we're going to have enough of it to go around.
In East Anglia and southeastern Britain, it's been one of the driest springs ever. And while some might be enjoying the early barbecues and picnics, it's not been good news for those who rely on those April showers, like our farmers.
Next tonight, it's here. After months of drought warnings, a hosepipe ban officially began in parts of our region today.
We begin tonight with the oppressive heat wave in the west, intensifying the already critical drought.
The lack of rain accompanied by heat waves. This is the worst drought to hit South Africa since 1982. Millions are facing water shortages.
Picture the Sahara, the world's largest hot desert. There's endless yellow sand that stretches across plains and hills, and oppressive heat that seems to come from all angles. There's hardly any shade. And of course, very little water. Half of the Sahara Desert receives less than 50 millimetres of rain every year, with some areas never seeing any rain at all. This is an image of what our world could look like without water. So can you imagine what you'd do to stop this happening where you live? Wars have been fought over less important resources. So how far would you go to ensure that water flows through your tap, that you have unlimited access to clean drinking water? How far should we go? Could the scarcity of an essential resource necessary for our survival be the cause of the next international conflict? That is our question today. Will the next war be about water?
So water, it's everything, right? I mean, you know that. As a human being, you're like mostly water. Any idea of the percentage?
I'm going to say like 80, but maybe that's a bit high.
That is high. A newborn baby is 78% water, which is quite a good stat, isn't it?
And then slowly desiccates.
Just drying out. So I'm probably like got less water than you have. But
you look like you have. Yeah. Like a walnut.
Adults are about 55 to 60% water.
Okay.
I quite like that. Obviously, it's essential. I mean, you know, we'll know this from our science knowledge. You know, biology basically works via water. You don't get biology working without it. So,
good transport system, isn't it?
It's fantastic. I mean, it's just sort of everything, really. It guides molecules, how they bond with DNA. It helps proteins to fold. And actually, we couldn't exist without some of water's weird properties, like the fact that ice expands. So, water expands on freezing, which means it's less dense, which means it floats on top of the ocean.
Which is really weird.
It's the only substance that does
it. Yeah. I can't, I used to know why as well, and I can't remember.
It's to do with the hydrogen bonds and to do with something to do with the sort of way that the molecules link up together. So you've got H2O binding to H2O with a couple of spare electrons from the oxygen molecule. And it all sort of adds up to it just sort of, you know, being slightly further apart than when it's liquid.
it's not the best explanation I've ever heard.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know that we want to get into the details of the chemistry here,
no,
do we?
No, fine.
Do we,
fine.
Really?
No,
but the point
don't.
Is that if it sank, like every other solid, it would be more dense than the liquid, mm-hmm. then you basically have oceans frozen solid, and that would be that. There'd be no life. So,
it's true, actually. It's never thought about that.
Yeah.
It's mad.
I mean, that one fact, that one sort of thing about the hydrogen bonds, basically allows everything to exist on Earth.
Wow.
It's quite mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another question for you. How much water do you think you use every day?
Ooh. As in how much I drink? Or...
No, give me litres, just your household use.
Oh, okay. Is this including sort of like the production of like my clothing or anything like
no,
that?
No. Literally just day-to-day life
okay, yeah.
in the house.
120 litres.
That's not a bad guess. Not a bad guess. The average person in the UK uses 142 litres per day if they've got a meter. If they haven't got a water meter, it's 166.
Of course it is. Just leave the taps running.
Of course you do.
Yeah, fuck them.
So average family of four in the UK use about 500 litres a day. I looked up my water bills. We're at like 565 litres on average. So I had a big go at my family over that, obviously. Yeah. Like, you take too long in the shower. Get out of the shower. I'm going to put a clock in the shower so you can time yourself. They were having none of it, obviously.
I mean, it goes without saying that I love hearing you talk about water, but have we enlisted an expert as well?
Yes, of course we have. Yeah, we've spoken to Dr. Benjamin Pohl, who's the head of the Climate Diplomacy and Security Program at Adelphi. So he works on water management policy, right, and basically addressing, you know, the challenges of security and development, all that kind of stuff. Because what we're really talking about is not, you know, personal water use in our houses, but like, what is the global situation with water?
What did we ask him first?
So the first thing we asked him was, just how scarce is water?
Well, if you're in the desert, it's very scarce. I mean, I think the normal water scarcity cutoff is usually calculated as 1,000 cubic meters per year per person. And obviously, that's still a lot. So this is not about, that's not a threat to having enough water to drink. But most of the water is actually used for agriculture. And depending on the technology you're using, and especially if you're not using much technology but are faced with a lot of evaporation, you do need a lot of water for that. So it's, the scarcity is very relative. But in many regions of the world, there's been a huge increase in demand for water due to agriculture, due to population growth, due to also greater industrial use. And so it's over time, it's become much more much scarcer.
So basically, there should be enough water to go around, but there isn't. I mean, it's not fairly distributed. So obviously, all the water that we need, we get from lakes and rivers and streams, but half of the world's important rivers are now significantly polluted or depleted. So, you know, they're just drying up. And then, you know, you get drought, so you get failed rainfall. All of a sudden, you know, you've just got nothing going on. But the thing is that like, you know, there's actually so little water available. So 97.5% of all the water on Earth is either salt water or polluted water now. So you've got 2.5% left. Nearly 70% of that is frozen into glaciers, which is, you know, obviously, you know, we want it to stay frozen into glaciers and the polar ice caps. And actually, it's less than 0.01% of all water worldwide is actually available for human use. So there's not...
As in drinking water.
Yeah. So and hygiene water. And 70% of that gets used for agriculture. So when you get down to sort of personal hygiene, ability to sort of survive a day without water, once you start to sort of deplete rivers, pollute rivers, you're in big trouble. So now we've got 40% of the world's population having water scarcity. 3 out of 10 people don't have access to safe drinking water. And over 2 billion people live in countries that have high water stress. So that's, you know, that's a lot. I mean, the population of the Earth is 7.8 billion, right?
Mm.
So 2 billion of that having high water stress, and 4 billion have high water stress for at least a month of the year. So, you know, there's clearly something sort of going wrong. And we're basically using more, making less available. And, you know, it's sort of a huge problem.
And polluting more, presumably.
Of course we are. Yeah.
So is it getting worse?
Yeah, it's definitely getting worse. So basically the water demand is increasing. So we're looking at sort of, you know, 20 to 30% higher by 2050. So it's sort of climbing quite considerably. Meanwhile, you know, we're actually sort of just pollution is, as we know, just taking over and making it harder and harder to use the water that we do have. So it's not great.
I'm hoping this isn't a stupid question, but it also might be. Is there a finite amount of water?
Yes, there is.
Good. I'm glad that's not stupid.
No, it's not. It's a good question, isn't it? So some of the water on Earth comes from comets and some of it seems to have naturally been here.
Yeah.
But it's not coming in from outer space. I mean, it's literally...
It's sort of a closed system, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
The water cycle is just sort of, it just goes round.
I mean, you learn
round,
it in geography, don't you, at school? You do the water cycle and it's boring and you just think, oh God, I've got to draw the clouds, draw the river. And yeah, this is what I remember from my geography lesson.
Yeah.
And actually, it turns out this is like
draw a lake.
Yeah, obviously. This is a crucial aspect of humanity that's causing ever-increasing problems, as Dr. Pohl explains.
Part of the reason is demographic growth, and is that there's more and more people, and obviously there's also a lot of demographic growth in areas where there is not that much water. But then the other part of the equation is, of course, the demand for water, which in many cases is unchecked, because water historically has been for free. And so people are used to using as much water as they like. And obviously that won't hold forever, because there's more people trying to use it. And there's, of course, also due to technologies, there's a, you know, a much greater scale at which we are using water. And so that's part of the answer. Of course, another part is that hydrological cycles are changing due to climate change. That's, I think, by comparison, still the smaller impact. But of course, it always depends on where you are on the globe and how dependent you are on the water. And as I said earlier, I mean, it's farmers in particular who are dependent, and there's not that much flexibility on their end. They need a certain amount of water, otherwise they're in danger of losing their livelihoods.
So presumably this is where the fear comes from, that you might end up with conflict.
Yeah.
If you've
got
loads of people living in places where water is incredibly scarce, then at some point people are going to start fighting over it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, taking someone else's water supply is kind of the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
Mm.
You imagine if we were put in a position where all the taps were turned off, you know, there was no source, but, you know, somebody knew like a place to go, you know, it would quickly sort of get around. You'd quickly have scuffles breaking out, and, you know, you can imagine this, but this actually starts to happen on sort of national scales as well. So about a decade ago, the UN began to introduce a global water convention on transboundary rivers, so those that cross national borders,
right,
and lakes as well. And so far, only 47 countries have actually signed up for it, because it's, you know, it's like, well, I don't know if I want to actually be bound by this. Guess who's not on it? Number one country that's not on it?
China?
Yes. I mean, China is naughty on this.
No way in hell China was going to be on it.
No, I mean, China has there's sort of very little incentive to be on it apart from wanting to be seen as a good guy. And I don't think that that's kind of high on the list necessarily.
It's not one of their sort of abiding principles with international diplomacy, is
but
it?
Also, you know, they've got a couple of important rivers for them that they can use for hydroelectric power that generate massive amounts of power if they put a dam in.
Mm.
And unfortunately, that means the people downstream are going to get less water. I mean, the flow has sort of reduced. So there's the Mekong River, which flows down into Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And China wants to put a dam in quite high upstream. And
everyone else is saying, hold on.
No, I'm not really keen on that. But, you know, they're basically going to build this dam. You know, they're going to dam it. They're going to get power out of it. And not just...
And there's nothing those countries downstream can do about it, really.
Yeah,
you basically just say, oh, please don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Or ask the international communities to put pressure on China. And we know how well that works. Yeah. And India as well has sort of actually had skirmishes with Chinese troops. So on the border... over rivers. I think it was like in May last year, in fact, 20 Indian soldiers died sort of attempting to sort of protect a portion of the river that is just not protectable because it's slightly inside China's border.
Hmm.
So you get this sort of situation where, you know, you've got the Indus and the Ganges and the Sutlej all originate in Tibet, basically, as does the Mekong. So you've got Tibet up there, mm-hmm. glaciers, lovely load of flow coming down, you know, in all directions. And China's saying, well, you know, this is ours and we're going to use it. Thank you very much. And then, you know, you've got like Pakistan, which has got basically 76% of its water needs originate outside of the country. Because it's not a proper country, is it? Because it was, you know, created by the British, effectively. You know, you sort of see now why geographical nations formed themselves in certain ways, so they had protective resources. And Pakistan is just screwed by this, really. But anyway, that's a bit of politics.
I didn't mind it.
And then, so there's the Brahmaputra River in India, northern India, and China's planning to build the world's largest dam on the basic, like, their side of the border.
I mean, it's not funny.
It's not funny.
But it is also quite funny.
No, I mean, there's like estimated 1.8 billion people sort of fed by this river, or watered by this river, I should say. And 60% of Bangladesh's population relies on it. And the Chinese are just saying, well, we need the power, we need the electricity. So I'm afraid we're going to put a dam in there. I mean, it's not just the Chinese, right? So
No, of course not. Turkey
hasn't covered itself in glory either, because it's dammed. It's got the Ilisu Dam on the Tigris. Waters flow into Syria, Iraq, and Iran, and they basically halved the flow into Iraq. So in 2019, people got really ill because the water just seemed to be more and more polluted. And partly that was, so in Basra particularly, people had started polluting the water anyway. And then the Turkish reduction in the volume just made it more and more concentrated pollution. And you had like 120,000 people in hospital in Basra. Going to hospital.
All due to the water pollution?
Basically due to the water pollution.
Wow.
And then, yeah, you reduce the flow, and then at the other end, the salt water comes up, basically to take the, you know, it can flow further up the river, so you're ruining agricultural lands. at the bottom. So, you know, this kind of stuff matters, which is why Egypt and Sudan did a joint war exercise last year called Guardians of the Nile. And basically it was on the Ethiopian border, because the Ethiopians are also talking about building a dam and saying, you know, okay, this is our water right here. It's a nightmare.
This is when you realise that you've had quite a sort of British-centric blinkered view, because I just hadn't really thought about where your water originates, because obviously...
Because all of us is
in the UK.
But you know, global issues, you know, and you can imagine that this sort of can escalate potentially
into something,
which is
be fuming if someone's saying to you, oh yeah, your main river that supplies you with water, we're just going to dam it just over the border. And there's nothing you can do about it.
And there isn't really, is there? So, you know,
no.
And of course, with climate change, that's going to sort of get worse, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Dr. Pohl there sort of mentioned climate change briefly. I assume climate change is going to affect our access to water and probably not help the situation massively.
This is what he had to say.
climate change is changing many of the natural systems, including the water cycle. So what that means in practice is that the climate that we've had for the, let's say, past 10,000 years, which was fairly stable, and which is a period that, you know, geologically is called the Holocene, because that was the stable climate that enabled, in many ways, human civilization. This is changing, and we're now talking about being in the Anthropocene. That means humans have already, in many ways, changed many of the Earth's systems. If you're not careful, we might tip the Earth system into a totally new equilibrium. Now, in itself, for the Earth, that doesn't matter that much. It will just change as it has changed in the past. But for us, we are dependent on the weather and on the stability, or we have been dependent on that stability, as I said, during the course of human civilization. So it's really unclear how we are going to deal with a very different world in the future. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a horror scenario, because we also have a lot of new technological means and societal resilience to deal with this, but a change is coming, and it's a big change. And so if, let's say, there's a certain region where we used to have a certain amount of precipitation and we don't have that anymore, or we have far more, then we don't really have the natural infrastructure and the livelihoods that are adapted to that new reality. So if it's too dry, then perhaps farming becomes impossible, or even herding becomes impossible. And if it's too wet, we'll need a lot of flood defenses in order to, you know, defend the way we are living and where we are living. And so it'll change, you know, where we live, what we can eat, and so on and so forth.
I listened to him say that, and talked about the Holocene, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, Holocene, what's that mean? Because I know we're sort of, people say we're now in the Anthropocene,
yeah,
which you can say is, you know, anthrop means like human-centered, mm-hmm, era. Right? So I was like, oh, I don't know what the Holocene actually means. So I looked it up. And do you know what it means?
No.
It means most recent era. I mean, isn't that a terrible name? That was given in 1850. Yeah. Somebody said, I'll tell you what we should call this era now. And it's really? Not really going to survive, is it? The
lazy.
I mean, it's not aging well.
No.
Yeah. So we're in the Anthropocene now, which is incredibly, you know, sort of apposite, really. I mean, it is the name, isn't it? Because we are affecting the planet on a global scale.
Yeah. And it didn't sound massively optimistic what Dr. Paul was saying there. Like, yeah, it might be okay. There was a little bit of techno optimism thrown in, where he's like, yeah, it might be that we come up with some technology that will make it all okay. But fundamentally, climate change might make some places just too dry.
Yeah.
Nightmare. Some places too wet.
Yeah.
It's all just like extremes. Like, any extreme is bad.
That's the huge problem with it. So what you do is, areas that are prone to droughts just get more and more droughts. Areas that are prone to flooding get more and more flooding. So the kind of inequity of you know, and the
everything
flooding
gets
everything just gets worse. So so apparently a global temperature rise of 2 degrees would increase the number of people suffering from water scarcity by 40%. And 2 degrees isn't that far off what we're looking at, really.
No.
So this is a problem that's only going to get worse with climate change. And what we've seen is like a massive increase in flood-related disasters already.
Mm.
You know, so when you sort of chart them sort of over the course of this century so far, it's gone up 134%. And the droughts have increased by 29%, apparently. So you know, what we're saying about extreme weather just, you know, it gets worse and worse and worse.
So the frequency of these extreme weather events,
yeah,
is increasing.
Exactly. Hmm. And the weird thing, I mean, obviously it happens in areas of the world that, you know, we're quite insulated from in some ways, but we sort of tend to see those areas of the world as being like conflict areas, like, you know, Somalia. And Somalia is a good example, actually, because last year, or no, in 2020 it was, all the displacements of people, 3/4 of those were to do with water scarcity, nothing to do with conflict at all.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, 1/4 of them were conflict, but, you know, 3/4 were just people going looking for water because you can't live without it.
Can you make me feel any better here?
Not really. So by 2040, you've got 1 in 4 children living in areas of high water stress. And, of course, rising sea levels, what happens there?
where you start to lose your low-lying sort of coastal cities and inhabitable areas.
And they become salt water. So they're all the agricultural land by the sea becomes salty water land that you can't farm.
Useless for farming.
I mean, the amazing thing
when we say, sorry, can I ask, when we say high water stress, do we mean in both directions? So either somewhere where it's flooding or where it's unbelievably dry?
Yeah, because if you get flooding, then what you can't do is treat the water in any way. So you can't maintain sanitation. Right. You can't keep wells, you know, pure. They basically get contaminated really bad. So too much water is, as you know, in some ways as bad as not enough, in that people don't die from the water, or that they die from the contaminants within the water. So, you know, it's not good either way. The amazing thing is that actually our problems with water actually make climate change worse as well. So at the moment, we don't treat 80% of the global wastewater. It just sort of gets released back into the sort of general sort of, you know, rivers, fens, brackish areas and everything else. And lots of that has organic matter in it that then decomposes and produces methane. Really powerful greenhouse gases. So, yeah, I mean, it's not great.
Bad feedback loop to be in.
Yeah, very much so. But there is hope. All right. So there is the possibility that we can alleviate water problems, because, you know, you look at the ocean and you say, can't drink that.
Mm. Or can I?
Or can I? Maybe I can just take the salt out of it. So we asked Dr. Pohl, if we're short of fresh water, why not just convert seawater?
That is, weirdly, it's the thing that if you ask a child, it's the first thing that you think when you say there's water scarcity, and you just go, but what about all of the water? The planet's covered in water. Can we do something with that?
Well, let's see what he had to say.
It's a good question. And hypothetically, we could. I mean, it just takes a huge amount of energy to desalinate water. And so it's still quite expensive. It's not that expensive, but it's expensive. And as I said, I mean, most of the water is being used for very little added value in farming. So it's not really worth it to desalinate water to then use for farming. Of course, it's worth it for producing drinking water, but not for just covering the ground with it. So yes, in hypothetically, we could. But on the other hand, I mean, there is a lot of fresh water that is available, and there's a huge wastage of water. And the cheaper option, rather than desalinating ocean water, would be to introduce better mechanisms for shifting the demand for water and for making people more aware of its value.
Okay, so expensive. It feels to me like there should be a way of harnessing the sun. So you're just sort of getting, you're taking a load of seawater and then you're using the energy from the sun to evaporate the water, leaving the salt, and then you collect the evaporated water. It condenses and then it sort of, you know.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like something
like
that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it sort of feels like the obvious thing to do. And people are using like heat flashes to do that to a certain degree. But what they don't do necessarily is like go all the way down to just the salt left.
Right.
Because it becomes, I guess, diminishing returns.
So.
So, I mean, there's lots of desalination plants. The other thing you can do is like osmosis. So like, you know how in cells, if you get too much salt in your body, basically your kidneys will filter it out. But your biological cells, they will all filter it out, you know, because they're able to sort of decrease the salinity of the water in your body. And you can do the same thing just by creating filters where you pump water up against a membrane that traps the salts but pushes through the actual water molecule. So you end up with water on the other side, and you just like harness that off. And that's energy intensive, obviously.
I was going to say, because osmosis is going in the other direction.
Yeah, so this is reverse osmosis.
Yeah, so you have to put energy in for it to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can do that. And there's lots of plants around the world that are sort of trying various forms of desalination, a lot of them in the Middle East. So there's massive amounts in sort of. In fact, the 10 biggest plants are in UAE, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Dubai. Mm-hmm. So that's where the sort of the, you know, the big mean desalination plants are. But there's
kind of
those
makes
more
sense. Hot.
Yeah.
see there.
Yeah, yeah. Presumably they're using some solar energy as well. You'd have thought.
You'd assume. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not a genius, but they can have that one for free if they like.
You're very welcome, guys.
But I mean, there's in Singapore, they do it in California. Lanzarote, I didn't realize. I was looking into this. Lanzarote. I mean, I've been to Lanzarote a few times.
And?
And I've obviously drunk.
How's the water?
I've drunk desalinated water. I didn't notice it. Notice anything about it. Yeah, I guess so. There's one in Beckton, East London.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, desalination plant.
And so, what are they using?
Well, presumably the Thames Estuary water.
No, but what's the process? Where are they getting the energy from?
It's not going to be solar, is it, in Beckton?
I wouldn't have thought so, no.
Yeah, we've got another glass full for you if anyone wants it. And the other problem with desalination, which I hadn't really clocked until I started looking into this, is that you end up with, like, you've got your sort of more briny water that's left
very,
over.
Very, very salty.
Very salty water. Yeah. Water. And a lot of places just tend to, like, chuck that back into the sea.
Ah.
And you sort of think, well, it's just salt water going into the sea. That should be fine, shouldn't it? But actually, what's happening is you're making the area in which you pump out that water extremely salty. So there's a couple of places in China where they're now losing biodiversity because of the extremely salty water that they're putting back in. In California, you're just not allowed to do that. You have to find another way. And you know, so the Californian desalination plants, they have to either pump it out sort of very slowly and or with sort of dispersants so that it's not all concentrated in one place, or they have to find other ways to do it. And there's plants sort of being set up to do the whole, like, you know, let's reduce it all the way back to salt and just take all the water. But that's, there's diminishing returns. It's not much energy
you have to put in to do that.
Exactly. It's not energy efficient. So although, you know, we want to say yes, desalination should work, actually it's not going to be that sort of magic bullet that we're kind of hoping for.
Okay, so the question that we're asking is, will the next war be about water? And I mean, to be honest, from what you're saying, people are already fighting over it. Climate change is going to make it worse. Desalination isn't going to solve the problem. On its own, at least. So it feels like, that's depressing, it feels like the answer might be yes.
Shall we see what Dr. Pohl had to say?
Yeah.
No, I don't think we will go to war over water. I think water can lead to conflict, usually non-violent conflict, and thereby indirectly contribute to tensions and fragility, but I don't think we'll see a full-blown water war, and certainly not between countries.
Genuinely delighted to hear that.
I mean, yeah,
what's the reasoning?
Well, I've read so many articles that say, oh, you know, war's going to be about water. Mm. Yeah, water wars. It sounds good, doesn't
catchy,
it? It is catchy. The reason is that India can't just march into China and say, you're not building that dam. I mean, there's just a disparity, a sort of inequality of power, effectively, isn't there? Mm-hmm. And so if you're geographically lucky, and you sort of sit in that place where all the water is and where it's all coming from, like, you know, Tibet, for instance, happens to be, you know, arguably in China,
part of China. Let's not get into that, I don't think.
But, you know, China's very much taking Tibet as its own.
Yeah, Bagsy Tibet.
Yeah, and of course, that's the source. So, you know, that's the source of all this stuff. And India, I mean, China's, you know, you're not going to go to war with China because you just aren't going to win.
Yeah.
And you're not going to march in and break the dam or whatever. So there's not going to be a war, partly because the people on the receiving end of the problem just haven't got the resources to fight.
So, yeah. So what I'm wondering is if that is a coincidence or it's a feature of the geography. So is it a coincidence that the countries who are going to get screwed over by the other country, the adjacent country, putting a dam in, they're not in a position to attack? Whereas if it was the other way around, so if it was India putting a dam up and it meant that it was restricting China's access to water, and China might invade India.
Yeah.
Because they would feel like that's something they could win.
Yeah, it's not something you can't see happening, is it? I mean,
no.
Yeah, so I wonder.
Is that coincidence? That's really interesting.
Well, I think it kind of is geographical coincidence, because China itself has, you know, massive amounts of poverty. Has, you know, it wants the power, you know, the the energy from these dams, because it really needs it to sort of, you know, lift its population. It's got lots of desert. It's got, you know, it's not got a huge amount going for it, really, except it's got this water. So I would say that the power that they have doesn't come from the water itself. It's just, you know, they happen to have the water and they are a powerful nation.
So what about Turkey? Who's not going to invade Turkey? Well, I suppose Iraq's not going
Iran,
to invade.
Iran, Iraq, Syria. It doesn't feel likely they're going to band together and just like go into Turkey, does it? And I imagine that, you know, as Dr. Pohl does, there's a lot of behind the scenes diplomacy that goes on to sort of try and stop, you know, anyone.
Please don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We really need that water, guys. Yeah.
You really need that water, but you know, let us find a different kind of solution. So, interestingly, it seems obvious that it's something you should go to war over because it's so essential to life. But actually, the sort of real politic of it says that, you know, that's not going to happen.
So that's good. So we're saying a large scale, like maybe little skirmishes, but a large scale conflict, large scale violent war does seem unlikely then.
Yeah.
I'm much happier at the end of this episode than I was at the start.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Dr. Benjamin Pohl. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want answering, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. That's stak.london. Or you can always find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around the duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.